Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is John Gingrich. I'm a managing director with Accenture, and we are proud to sponsor this evening's event. You might already know that Accenture provides management consulting, technology, and outsourcing services in 120 countries with 320,000 employees. It's also important that at our core, we're a people-based business. And as the people lead for Accenture's Northern California location, I'm always personally interested to hear how others achieve success in hiring and motivating employees to make their company a better place to work. It is therefore my pleasure to introduce my good friend Laszlo Bock, Senior Vice President of People Operations at Google and author of Work Rules, Insights from Inside Google That Will Transform How You Live and Lead. At Google, Laszlo is responsible for attracting, developing, and retaining talent and has helped the company grow from 6,000 employees from when he first started to nearly 60,000 today in 40 countries. Under his tenure, the company has been recognized over 100 times as an exceptional employer, including Best Company to Work in the U.S., the number one top diversity employer, and Best Company for Women in Technology. In 2010, Laszlo was named Human Resources Executive of the Year by HR Executive Magazine. Prior to joining Google, Laszlo held executive positions at the General Electric Company and McKinsey & Company. Laszlo received his bachelor's degree from Pomona College, and we're happy to have a contingent of fellow sagehens here in the room. Carol, Pam, hi everybody. And also received his MBA from Yale University, and there are also a number of fellow alums from Yale today as well. I've had the pleasure of knowing Laszlo for a number of years. We share a common bond of having attended the same high school and college, and we stay connected today on life in general. So I'll share this with the group. What I admire most about Laszlo is his unpretentious approach to living life, his intellectual curiosity, and his generosity. Qualities that I see in the interactions that I have with him, and that I think come through in this book that we'll discuss this evening as well, which has already been named one of the top business books of the year. Moderating tonight's conversation is Farhad Manju, technology writer for the New York Times. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Laszlo Bock and Farhad Manju.
Hi. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Holy cow, there's a lot of people here.
Yeah. You're used to this, right? Do you talk to Googlers a lot?
I talk to Googlers, to Google employees. Not so much. They don't normally let us out to talk to the public. So I hope they're nice. They look friendly.
I've interviewed Laszlo a couple times before. We've talked about various subjects, people analytics, which is we'll get to. We recently talked about diversity at Google, which we'll probably get to. Maybe we should just start, though, but with where you start the book, which is how you got to doing HR, which you don't even call HR at Google, how you got to do what you do now.
So my career has been kind of a professional disaster. It's like a lot of careers where as you're kind of living your life forward, it doesn't make any sense. And then in retrospect, you have to get a job. So in the interview, you kind of knit it together. Out of college, I started a nonprofit. I worked as an actor. I worked at the Olive Garden as a waiter, which was as you would expect, and had some very cool moments.
I've heard it's better now, so.
I'm sure. Worked at small companies and big companies, and anyway, ended up at business school. And from there, did what sort of, a third of business school students dream of doing and went to McKinsey & Company, which is finishing school or charm school for MBAs. And then after about 4 years, realized I'd always been frustrated in my career because of the disconnect between what managers espoused as their values and what they actually did. And part of it was just hubris, being young and sort of, being impatient with the people around me. And I realized that I wanted to actually do something about that. And the two paths were, like every person who has an MBA and works at McKinsey, I could, fight for the next 20 years to try to become a CEO and shape something. Or I kind of realized I could make this left turn into human resources, and I would never be a CEO, probably, but I would have broader impact, and maybe because my background was different from most people who go into HR, I could move more quickly. So I cold called GE and Pepsi. I was living in Connecticut. I cold called GE and Pepsi because they were the best places for HR, reputedly at the time. One person called me back from GE. I got a job there. And 3 years later, Google called and asked if I wanted to go and run what would become people operations at Google. And it was 2 years after the company had gone public. It was actually still viewed as kind of a risky thing. The Fortune magazine article cover at the time was, is this company really worth $95 a share? and so I went.
So what's interesting about that is, first of all, you didn't at first see yourself doing HR. But do you even consider yourself doing HR now? I mean, you don't call it that at Google. Why don't you call it that? And what's different about how you guys do it?
So I absolutely do consider that I do human resources. It's an awful name for a profession because it's kind of a very like, you know, George Orwellian 1984 kind of thing. But, you know, it is what it is terms of branding.
Did it need a rebranding, basically?
Yeah. Well, so whether or not it did, it got one.
Yeah.
What ended up happening was, so I'm interviewing at Google. Don't think I'm going to get the job offer because, you know, nobody ever gets an offer from Google. I was interviewing for a job which was the head of human resources, and I get the offer letter, and it said head of people operations. And remember, I'm at GE, my family's on the East Coast, I'm kind of, you know, established and thinking, you know, I need some protection because if I go to this company called Google, which is viewed as kind of dicey at the time, and it doesn't work out, I got to be able to explain to my next company what my job was. So I called Google back and said, like, you know, hey, this people operations thing, that's a great title, love it. Can we just use human resources? You know, because that's what I thought I was interviewing for, and I didn't tell them it was because I needed an insurance policy. So what they said to me was, well, why don't you give it 6 months? Because if you say human resources, the engineers won't respect you. But I was told, if you have the word operations in it, the engineers will think it's technical and they'll like you more. So I say, okay. I show up and I go around meeting all the leaders of the company, and I meet Urs Holtzley, who was employee number 10 or 11. He basically designed all our data centers. So he's the guy who figured out how to back up the internet and store it everywhere, and brilliant, brilliant guy. And he looks at my resume and my packet as we're sitting down, and he goes, oh, people operations. That's a great title. So I didn't change it.
Do you know who came up with it?
Shona Brown. So Shona Brown was running business operations at Google at the time, and she's the one who suggested it. Great branding instincts. But it also, we've used it to sort of actually do something a little bit different in how we approach the people stuff and introduce a lot of science and analytics and sort of do everything we can not to replace decision-making that people make, but to supplement, to complement human decision-making with a little science, which actually helps you make much better decisions, it turns out.
But I've heard you say before, and you go to it into it in detail here, you guys think of human resources as doing something different from what many companies would think of. And I think the typical employee's encounter with you guys would be different from at most other companies. So let's just sort of discuss that at a high level. Like, what's different about Google HR?
Well, there's a couple things. From an employee perspective, we try to be really transparent. So we try to share not just the rationale of how we do things, but for example, when we're figuring out, so at Google we have salaries and bonuses and everybody gets equity, stock. When we're figuring out what the relationship between your performance and what your reward is, we actually get a group of employees and we say, here's an anonymized data set of all the employees in the company. Monkey around with the data and tell us what you think looks fair. You know, for this rating with this kind of track record, should somebody get a $10,000 bonus or a $20,000 bonus? So we're transparent in that respect. We're also very transparent in terms of how everyone is assessed. So there's all kinds of employee surveys we do, which we can talk about. But we encourage all the managers and we encourage the whole company to share it with everyone so everyone can see what's going on. And the third thing that's maybe different is we really try to look for ways to say yes when people get stuck. Even if it's bizarre, even if it's, you know, exceptional, because at the end of the day, rules are great and policy is great, but we're all kind of messy human beings and, you know, we stumble into kind of bizarre, odd situations. And it's easy to kind of say like, no, that's our policy, or we haven't done that before. And what we really try hard to do is find ways to say yes when somebody's really struggling. I can share more on that if that's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, what's an example of that?
One thing we used to do that evolved into a policy was, when I joined the company, so when I started interviewing at the company, we had about 4,000 employees, and when I joined, we had 6,000, which is both testament to how long the process took and how quickly Google was growing. And at that size, what would happen is, once every other year, you'd have an employee pass away, and it's tragic and shocking and awful. And then as we got bigger, 10,000, 15,000 people, it happened a couple, three times a year. And each time what would happen is we'd sit down as a management group and somebody would share, oh, this awful thing happened. And we'd say, well, what can we do to take care of the family, the spouse? And so we would literally just write checks to the surviving spouse. We'd say, well, this is going to sound nuts, but here's $1 million. Because we think about what the foregone income was and what the impact is, and it's such an awful, awful thing to go through when you have a spouse or a partner pass away. And we started doing that more and more as we got bigger, just, actuarially you do it more. And what I realized was that not everything was being escalated to the management team. It wasn't fair. Because what was happening was the benefits team would, of course, know about every claim because we had life insurance. And so we were saying yes and being helpful just because it felt like the right thing to do. And what we then did, though, because I realized it actually wasn't completely fair, is we formalized it into a policy. And so now the policy is if you pass away while you're at Google, all your stock vests immediately. And if you have a domestic partner or a spouse, they get half your salary for the next 10 years. If you have children, there's $1,000 a month paid until they're 18 or 24, depending whether they stay in school. But we didn't tell anybody about it because for about 2.5 years, mainly because it's not really a recruiting tool, right? Like, it's not like nobody joins thinking, I want this benefit, right? Like, so that's the kind of thing we try to say yes to.
So not that example, but I think in general people think about perks when they think about what's different about Google. So you hear about the free food and like the beanbag chairs and like the buses. You say in here that the culture and what makes Google Google is more than the perks. But explain sort of what role the perks play and then why they're sort of only a shallow way to look at Google.
Yeah. So the perks basically are. We do perks for three reasons, and perks range from obviously the food and the shuttles, but also things like we let Googlers teach one another. We encourage them to. So last year, 3,000 of our employees, we have over 50,000 employees now, 3,000 actually taught classes to other employees. That's a huge perk, right? Because we have classes on things like history of the bicycle and how to give presentations and all these random topics, and some actually related to our business because Googlers decided they wanted to teach. We do perks for three reasons. One is to build community, because we want people to feel kind of connected and happy. That's why we do things in part like have cafes, just so people can kind of come together and break bread. And in our cafes, if you've ever been on the campus, you notice the tables tend to be sort of, long lunch tables like you have in school wherever we can, because we want you to sit next to a stranger and maybe get pulled into a conversation. The second thing is we want innovation. And so that's why we have authors come and politicians and folks come on campus to just sort of give a talk. And each week we have, anywhere between 15 and it could be up to 30 or 40 across all our offices, talks going on just to kind of get these ideas flowing and expose people to new ideas. So the second reason is to kind of spur innovation. And the third is for efficiency, just to make life easy for people. So, and the beautiful thing about that kind of stuff is free. So we have on-site dry cleaning. You drop off your dry cleaning, you take it anywhere else. In Silicon Valley, this is not such a big deal because there's companies that do this, but anywhere you could actually just go to your local dry cleaner and say, can you just come by my office one day a week, pick up everyone's stuff? And Google doesn't pay for it. The beautiful thing is most of the things we do cost nothing. Cafes cost a lot of money. Do not give everyone free food. That costs a lot of money. Shuttles, where you give transportation, that's actually a net good. I know the buses draw a lot of attention, but we take something on the order of, I think, 12 or 15,000 cars off the road every day off the 101. So it's an awful commute. It's slightly less awful, you know, 1% less awful because we're shuttling people back and forth. But the rest of the stuff costs nothing. And it really kind of is something people enjoy. But to the second part of your question, when we survey Googlers about what do they value, why do they stay at the company, what's important to them, that kind of stuff never really comes up. They talk about the mission of the company. They talk about the quality of people they're exposed to. They talk about the sense of freedom they feel in being able to kind of shape their own destiny. And that's what kind of keeps people, not the bells and whistles.
I want to ask about the bells and whistles stuff for one. You didn't mention one thing that I've heard commonly. I've heard many people say this is a reason you give perks, which is to keep people working longer, to keep people at the office more, and you know, in some way to make it so that they never want to leave or have to leave.
Well, of course, that's what. I understand the logic because you look at it and say, well, of course you want people trapped there. But most of us, like knowledge workers, most of our work is discretionary effort, right? So we could like chain people to their desks and say, you have to be here for, you know, 10 or 14 hours a day or whatever. And it wouldn't make them do higher quality work. It wouldn't make them create or innovate. So it's not about shackling people or trapping them. In fact, you know, we don't actually really care too much where you work and what hours you work and things like that. And so you see this funny thing where actually, you know, because it's an engineering culture and I'm given to understand engineers like sleeping in. So, you know, people kind of don't stumble in until, you know, 9:30, 10:30. And then the shuttles start actually leaving the campus at like 3:30 or 4:30, right? So, and then later in the evening, you actually see kind of work pick up online. So people start emailing again once the kids are in bed and things like that. But we don't really have a strong view about where and when you work. You know,
but so there's no one at Google who's saying, you know, we're providing these shuttles that have Wi-Fi that allow people to work on the shuttles. We're going to get 3 more hours of work out of them every day.
No. No, in fact, I mean, I have no idea, nor have I ever asked. It's never kind of been an interesting question, like how many hours the average Googler works or, you know, where they do their work or, you know, we've never looked at do the cafes make, you know, there's an In-N-Out across the street from our office, right? It's not hard to escape and, you know, get over there and get a burger. We've never looked at that kind of stuff. What we do ask about is how are people feeling in terms of well-being? Like, do they feel healthy? Do they feel happy? Do they feel motivated? Because the hours, again, like, it doesn't matter. Like, we've all had times where you work, like, crazy long hours and work weekends and you finish and feel motivated and energized because you're doing important, impactful work. And then, we've also had days where you work, like, 4 hours and you kind of go, oh, this is the worst, dumbest job in the world. Like what? And you're enervated and depressed. So it's totally not about the hours. It's about creating an environment where people actually want to put in that effort. And sometimes that environment is, you know, on the commute home, and sometimes it's at home, and sometimes it's in the office.
So let's talk about the other part of what you said, which is that people in surveys say they're working for this mission. So in the book, you talk about how, I mean, you weren't born in the United States. Google's mission is kind of revolutionary. Can you just kind of go over your story? I don't want to repeat it. So.
I was born in Romania, communist regime behind the Iron Curtain, Warsaw Pact country. Kind of an awful, awful place. A lot on the same continuum as kind of North Korea today in terms of people spying on their families, teachers spying on students, students spying on parents. People just would disappear, like awful, awful things. And my folks had always wanted to be free, like I think everyone does. And so in 1974, we defected. We snuck out across the border, stayed in a refugee camp, applied for political asylum, came to the United States. And so I was raised with this deep appreciation of the freedom that we enjoy here. And, you know, the luxury of being in a democracy is you can also complain about things you don't like. But this tremendous sense of kind of freedom and ability to express yourself, and something that is easy to forget, that it's actually a pretty remarkable, unusual thing, not just in the world, but in the span of human history. And then I get, you know, years later, you know, I was 32 when Google called, and again, 33 when I got the job. But they, this mission, and every company's got a mission, and it sounds trite, or perhaps not credible to say it's meaningful. But this idea of organizing the world's information and making it accessible, like, really meant something to me. And I remember after joining, within a year, going to look at our book scanning operations. So, you know, Google had this operation where, you know, we would get all these books that were out of copyright and the ones that were in copyright, and people would just stand and turn the pages. Like, we had many, many people just turning pages, photo taken, book was scanned, onto the next one. And we put that content out there and said, you know, use it how you will. And when Amazon actually first populated their inventory for the Kindle, they used the books that Google scanned. Because we said, just use it. We didn't put any commercial constraints on it, right? And they built a great product, and, you know, it's a great thing to read on, and, you know, good for them. And it was just this amazing union of my background and kind of what's important to the company. Because imagine, like, if you want to understand the English language or the human condition, the idea that you can get the complete works of William Shakespeare anywhere in the world for free, right? It's just, it's literally revolutionary. And I have friends who are from India, who, you know, grew up there, a competitive school system, and they tell stories, people who are my age, right, who, you know, talk about having to share textbooks that were held together by twine because there was, you know, one textbook for 10 or 20 guys, typically guys living in a dorm, and it's just remarkable. And what we find is, even though we don't indoctrinate our employees on mission, people are attracted to the company because of it, and people stay because they feel some connection to it.
What is it about other companies? You go through several other corporate mission statements here, and they're all, you know, we've all read corporate mission statements before. They're hard to read, and they don't say much. They use a lot of words to sort of be purposefully vague. Is it just that Google's is simple and easy to understand and doesn't mention things like profit? And what should other companies do if they're established companies and they can't sort of start over? How do they sort of reform their mission?
Well, I think the Google mission, it's not unique, but it's distinctive in that it doesn't talk about shareholders, users, profits, money, market, anything like that, which is kind of weird and unusual. And what's most interesting about it is Larry and Sergey came up with this before the company was making any money, right? It's not like, oh, we're profitable, we're making a bunch of money, we can afford this idealistic mission. It was, we should do something idealistic. Oh my God, by the way, we discover 4 years later, it's incredibly profitable to do this idealistic thing, right? So the idealism preceded the economics. And looking at other companies, what's interesting, if you're an established company or a startup, is time and again, there's research, academic research, which I cover, that demonstrates that having a compelling mission actually drives higher productivity and lower costs. So, there's a guy, a professor named Kamal Burdi from the University of Sheffield. He looked at operations projects, so Six Sigma stuff, statistical process control, all these classic operation things, across a 30-year span of time, across something like 100 different companies. And what he found was none of these tools actually consistently improve performance. The one thing that does is empowerment. A professor from MIT named Michael Locke looked at Nike factories in Mexico. They took two factories, one T-shirt factories, and they allowed one people to just kind of do what they wanted and set their own goals, and the other they just managed in their traditional way. In the one they managed in the traditional way, they produced on average 70 shirts per person per day. In the one where they were given freedom, they produced 140 shirts per person per day. The employees were paid more because they were paid per shirt. The productivity was almost double, and the profitability was higher. So there's all these examples of companies doing this and having and connecting to something that's more than just profit, that's about giving people freedom or having impact on the world, and it really works.
Let's talk about this idea of empowerment. So you go in the book, you talk a lot about how Google views managers and kind of the powers that you give to managers and take away from managers. What is the role of a manager at Google, and how, as someone who works for a manager, how empowered am I to, like, disregard what the manager says?
Well, I should start by saying none of this stuff works perfectly at Google, because we're run by humans and we're fallible and we screw up. So I don't want to paint a picture that this is all, like, you know, without blemish. But we try to architect things so that it works pretty well as we can. And we take a lot of power away from managers. So if you're a manager at Google, you're not allowed to make a hiring decision. You can't decide who gets promoted. You can't unilaterally decide how big a bonus is or a stock grant or a salary increase. There's all these things that managers traditionally do that we don't permit them to. Instead, those decisions are made typically by a committee, and that committee is charged just with maintaining quality and fairness. And the reason is managers have incentives to kind of, first of all, we make bad judgments, right? Like we all think we're great at interviewing. By definition, we're actually average. We all will get, you know, if you're in sales, a client will say, can you give my niece a job? And you feel this pressure to hire the niece, even though she may not be qualified, right? So there's all this pressure on managers. And as an employee, you have incentives to kiss up to your manager and please them and do anything that you can so that they think you're great, rather than just like actually doing what you think is right. So by taking power away from managers, we actually limit the job to actually just making your team successful and coaching and influencing.
So what is why would I want to become a manager? What is the influence of that? What is the incentive for that?
A lot of people don't. Like, so half the company are technical engineers, product managers. Typically, they hate the idea of becoming a manager. They just view it as like not at all fun. And when we hire people into the company as managers, they typically don't like any of this stuff either. Mm-hmm. What they find, though, is that, you know, after 3 or 6 or 9 months, you realize you're actually surrounded by these amazing people because there's this quality bar that's independent of my fallible, messed up bias and judgment. And so the system actually works, and as a result, it's easier to get things done and we can be more productive. And we have a lot of people who actually decide, I kind of like helping the team. I like making people feel better and grow and learn, and they become some of our best managers.
Okay, so this is a bigger question, and I'm not sure if you can answer it. But so tech companies generally have kind of a short life cycle, and you see them be at the top of their industry, and then they, you know, falter or just aren't as good anymore. How do you know that Google is not in one of those periods now, and that like all this stuff about your culture is not, you know, responsible for your success? How do you know that there's a relationship there?
Well, I won't know for sure for another 30 years. I can meet you back here and report back. I think, first of all, it very well could be. You know, I don't know for sure. The reason I think it may have something to do with the culture is, number one, we've actually studied very, very closely the cycle of what happens to other tech companies and companies generally, but particularly tech companies. And there's definitely an arc they follow. And we're lucky in that we have two founders who kind of cared about this stuff from the very beginning and have had an expansive mindset saying, okay, their instincts turned out to be pretty good on a bunch of things related to people. And then we were able to prove that works. So, and because they're young, they're, you know, early 40s, we've got some good runway with them. But the other thing is the academic research and looking at other companies that do this kind of stuff has given me more confidence than I would have had. You know, if you look at other companies, you take a grocery chain like Wegmans, which is a Northeast grocery chain. Some people are nodding, and I bet if I said, you know, if you've heard of Wegmans, do you love it? Like hands, like, right? I mean, everyone who's heard of Wegmans have been to it just absolutely like loves this place. It's a grocery chain. Right, they have 1% margins compared to 30% for Google. They're family owned versus publicly held. We hire a ton of PhDs. They hire people who often don't finish high school, and they have the same idea of just giving people freedom and treating them well and giving them like a lot of responsibility, and they do a great job of it. So they do a lot of the same things without the science, and they've persisted for a lot longer than Google's been around. They actually were named the best company to work for the year before Google was eligible. And then the academic research, you know, I mentioned some of it before. But when you start looking at all these pieces, like how should you be interviewing? You know, we didn't do that stuff. We didn't do it correctly for years. We got better based on the academic research, and then we test to make sure it's actually predicting higher quality new hires. You know, performance management. We did a bunch of experiments. We looked at a bunch of academic research. We think we've landed in a fairly decent place. So between our own experience, which could be totally a one-off thing, but I hope it's not, the youth of our founders with good instincts, the supplement of data, the academic piece, and the fact that a lot of other companies that are much older than us have been doing this kind of stuff, just not in this industry, you know, I'm 51% confident in that this is the way to go.
So, you know, every time I hear you talk about this, and I was reading this book too, I felt like it seems like it should be right. But then I can think of examples of companies that are very successful that don't operate, don't have a similar culture. A very prominent one is Apple.
I'm not familiar with that one, but yeah, it's we'll take it as a hypothetical. I don't want to comment.
You know, like more hierarchical, somebody who kind of ruled the company with an iron fist for a while. You know, and you can think of many different companies that don't, you know, share various parts of your culture. So are you saying that if they adopt your culture, they'd be better? Like, or what are you saying about sort of the portability of your culture to other companies?
Well, I think I was once asked by a journalist, like, is this Google model inevitable? Do all companies, will people all want to be treated this way? And I realized, because I hadn't thought about it until I got the question. No, you can actually make a ton of money treating people really badly, right? And I'm not talking about any specific company. I really am not. Like, it sort of crystallized for me when I remember there was a company that was in the press years ago because there were a lot of, outside the U.S., employees were committing suicide. Like, the working conditions were so bad, people were killing themselves. They were jumping off the roof of these factories, right? These 3- and 4- and 5-story tall buildings. And the company response was to put up suicide nets. They installed nets sticking out of the 2nd and 3rd floor so that when somebody jumped, they would get caught, right? And it's a really profitable company, and it's still a growing concern. And so you can make a lot of money treating people really badly. I think you shouldn't, for two reasons. One is that I think talent is more mobile than it ever has been in the past, not just within sort of Silicon Valley, but globally. I mean, it's really possible to find the best people on the planet. And we've sort of widened our aperture at Google as well. So we don't really, you know, we used to care about where you went to school and your grades. We don't really care about that stuff anymore, right? We care about, you know, how you perform in our interview process because that actually predicts performance. So, you know, there's 4 billion workers out there and we're looking for the very best. So part of it is, and the best people will increasingly want to work at companies where they're treated well because they're mobile. And it's becoming easier to identify who the best people are. There's a ton of startups working on this too. So they're going to gravitate to places where they get treated with dignity and get freedom. But the second reason is, honestly, it's just the right thing to do. Like, how could you not? I mean, how badly do you want to make... I mean, everyone wants to make a living. Everyone wants to make money. Everyone has a, you know, fantasy of buying the lottery ticket or, you know, being employee number 3 at the next big startup. The research says, you know, on average, nationally, making more than $75,000 a year doesn't make you any happier. I think in Silicon Valley, it's got to be a little higher because housing's nuts here. It's like Manhattan or worse. But you kind of have to ask yourself, to what end? And at the end of the day, people, you know, you don't get to take it with you. So why not treat people well and, you know, have that be your legacy?
I'm sure you get this question a lot. I have 2 kids. What should I do with them to make sure they get jobs at Google?
Well, after this, I'll give you the secret handshake. And so there's a couple things. There's 2 completely contradictory sets of advice I'll give you. For Google, they should do interesting things. The best single thing they can do is, how old are your kids, if you don't mind?
2 and 4.
Okay.
So they're going to start in 2 years.
Master the fork, and we'll go a long way in the cafes. Well, what I was going to say, assuming they're a little older, the best thing they can do is actually reflect each day on what they learned. And this is something I actually do. Like, every day I drive home, and I use that time to think, you know, what did I do wrong today? And there's something every day. And what can I therefore learn from that, and what can I do better tomorrow? The single biggest thing, I think, that will get you prepared for a job at Google eventually is kind of reflecting on, is constantly learning and growing. And the easiest thing, the most unilaterally in your control way to do that is each day just to say, what did I learn today? And to try something different the next day. That's the Google answer. So that's what I'd suggest.
That's it? Seems like there's got to be more. Where should they go to school? What should they study?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I actually, like, totally didn't get that. It doesn't matter where they go to school. It used to. When we were small, up until a few years after I joined, we cared a lot about where you went to school. We had this immense database that we built of colleges and universities around the world, and we actually then sorted them not just by how good the school was, but by how good each department in the school was, right? Because some schools have, like, we'll have a great journalism department, everything else is bad, or they'll have a great computer science, everything else, and we didn't want to miss the students. So we cared about where you went to school, we cared about your GPA, we cared about your SAT scores, your GMAT, your LSAT, all this garbage. And what we realized was, first of all, there's that in a way is kind of a rigged game. Like, it's fine to get good grades. It's a very nice thing to get good grades and high test scores. But you're advantaged if you come from a background where your parents have degrees from nice schools, because they'll kind of tell you what to do. You're advantaged if you can afford test prep or if somebody tells you to do test prep. And it turns out none of that stuff actually predicts how you will perform at Google. Except for maybe the first year or two. Like, grades help predict that a little bit. And we were asking everyone we hired, like, you know, so I was, you know, over a decade out of college, and I was asked for my transcript and SAT scores and all this kind of thing. It was meaningless. And so we did a bunch of number crunching, which revealed that doesn't predict performance. Instead, what predicts performance is structured interview questions, which are kind of a super boring thing to talk about and an even more boring thing to write about, but fascinating to read about. But it really gripping. But you do this kind of interviewing, this structured interviewing, you actually end up with an interview process that predicts how someone will perform. And then we tested sort of, you know, well, we did all kinds of testing to make sure that that was actually true. So we stopped looking at all that kind of stuff, and we found, you know, we have a bunch of people who never went to college, people who dropped out of college, and including among some of our most senior executives, there's people who didn't go or didn't finish, and it turns out they do really well because not everyone goes to college, and all the smart people in the world don't go to college, and they learn really useful things in life that, in fact, make them great employees.
So, I mean, I think the larger thing you're getting at here is in the structured interview, in getting rid of sort of signals that don't matter, you're trying to get rid of bias in a larger sense. Can you talk about that and then sort of segue into this discussion about diversity, which Google has both struggled with and tried to address?
Yeah, so it turns out we're fallible, right? You know, so my computer scientist friends will say at any given moment we have 11 million bits of information coming at us, right? So not just what you see and hear, but if you think about it, you actually feel your clothes on you at every instant. You feel the air around you. You smell things. Your brain filters it all out because your brain can only process 40 bits of information at any given moment. There's cool tests you can do, which I write about, to like test your vision. It turns out you're basically like blind except for a tiny little spot. The test is basically take a playing card at random, a face card, hold it out at an arm's length, and stare straight ahead and move it slowly and try to see how close it has to be to directly in front of you to be able to identify it. Turns out it has to be like almost exactly in front of you, because it turns out peripheral vision sucks. And we have these things called saccades, where your eyes move around a lot and you sort of piece everything together because you're brain stitching this stuff. But we think we can see everything around us. We can't. Similarly, we think we make good decisions when we interview people. Turns out we don't. Turns out most interview decisions are made within the first 10 seconds, literally 10 seconds of an interview. And the rest is an exercise in confirmation bias. We think we're fair when we choose who to promote, but it turns out there's things like recency bias, which is, you know, if you and I just had this interview and I leave the stage, I'm like, what a fantastic experience, and tomorrow I have to assess Farhad, I'll say he's amazing. But 6 months from now, if I have to assess him, I'll say, well, yeah, he seems fine, you know, because if you do something recently, it skews your perception. And then you take that over to things like gender bias, bias against people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, ethnic, racial bias, religious. We're biased in all these different ways that we don't actually consciously realize. And so we've done a lot of work on we tried a lot of traditional diversity kind of stuff, and the challenge there is it's really hard to change someone's belief system. And it's not actually obvious to me you should. I mean, there's people who have abhorrent belief systems which should be changed. But for the most part, most people kind of think of themselves as pretty nice, pretty egalitarian. And yet we are all biased in very small ways that we don't even realize. And there's a lot of research on this. It then turns out, if you tell people in a compelling way. And what I'm doing now is not compelling. We have a video, we have an internal training program on this. And if you Google unconscious bias and Google ventures, you'll see it on YouTube. And we're going to put more out hopefully this year. That's a much better explanation. But it turns out if you explain to people that we're biased, whether it comes to hiring or promotions or what have you, their opinions don't change, but they pause when they're put in a situation where those biases are triggered and they kind of think rationally and they behave in a way that's a lot less biased. And when you do that, it turns out teams are more effective, people are happier, and you make better decisions, whether it's on a promotion or, you know, whether it's just having a mixed group together.
You released your demographic data last year, and you were one of the, I think, you were the first Silicon Valley company to do so, and a wave of other companies followed you in doing so. And you were lauded for releasing the data, but the data also showed that you were overwhelmingly a company of overwhelmingly men, and few blacks and Hispanics work at Google. In addition to the unconscious bias training, what else are you doing, can you do, to change those numbers?
Well, so it's a great question. We decided to put the data out there because, and other companies had shared the data by sharing these federal forms you have to file called EEO-1 forms, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission forms. They're kind of inscrutable and messy, and so we weren't the first, but we were the first to sort of make it legible and comprehensible. And we shared it because we felt like this is... We actually had the following conversation. We said, you know, the proportion of women, African Americans, Hispanics at Google is below what you see in society. It's about what we thought we saw in the tech industry based on our surveys and analysis, a little worse here and there, a little better here and there, but not good. And we thought we could just go and hire, for example, every woman from every other technology company, and then our numbers would be fantastic. And we'd look great. And we decided that actually wouldn't be the right thing to do because, for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is, it actually wouldn't solve the systemic problem we have. So we decided to put our data out there in order to just set a baseline and actually to put some pressure on ourselves because you can't just put it out once and never do it again. So we're going to republish this year. There'll be a little bit of improvement in some areas. There won't be, you know, it's not clear there's going to be a ton. So we're doing things inside the company. One of the things, too, is we're trying to be very clear that the onus is not just on people who are in the minority. The onus is on, actually, the people in the majority to change their conduct and behavior because they set the tone. And so we've done some cool stuff there. We're doing a lot of work to try to bring people into the field. There was a Googler who said, African-American, who said he wanted to go and spend 6 months or a year at Howard University and help work on the computer science curriculum. So he reached out to the head of the CS department there, who graciously agreed to kind of let this guy come in. And this year we have people at 5 historically black colleges and universities, and we went from 0 hires from any of these schools to, you know, having many, many, many more. And it's great. It's great progress, but we got to do this for a long time if we want to put a dent in this and do the right thing.
Okay. We have a whole bunch of audience questions, so I'm just going to go through them. Somebody wants to know, how do you change a place that is known to have a terrible culture like the DMV, or improve and ultimately improve, you know, their service to the end customer?
Well, I think one of the
DMV was the questioner's example.
That not your example?
Yeah, you know, I love the DMV.
I think, first of all, you sort of have to, you know, think globally, act locally. And what I mean by that is the first step is thinking of yourself as a founder, of thinking, like, what is within my control? So there's a woman named Amy Rosinsky. She's a professor at Yale University. She does work on something called job crafting. And what she found is whatever the job, first of all, in almost any job, people find meaning in the work and make it better. And she looked at doctors and lawyers and white-collar jobs. She looked at housekeepers and janitors. A third of the people find meaning, deep meaning in their work somehow. And then she said, for the other two-thirds, who just view it as a way to make money or, you know, climb the ladder, what can we do to make it more meaningful and have them be happier and more productive? And it turns out this thing she calls job crafting is basically like making a list of everything you do in the job, list the things that, and then identify the things you think are important and that you enjoy, and focus more on those. And it turns out the mere act of doing that makes people feel better. and makes them more productive and happier in that process. So just taking some ownership. And then look around your environment and think about what can you do without approval? What can you do just by like changing things around, right? And what can you do by getting other people to behave in a certain way? And that's how it starts. And then at a higher level, you ultimately have to make a decision about whether, you know, can you talk to your boss? Can you talk to peers of your boss and influence that way? And you may have to vote with your feet because some organizations won't change. But you at least can change your experience and what you do. And from there, if all this academic research and our experience is right, your productivity will actually be better. And if you are in an organization which values productivity, somebody will eventually say, what happened? And you'll say, oh, I did job crafting, or I took more ownership for this, or I started caring in this way. And they'll say, oh, let's do that elsewhere. And it'll build from that small experiment.
Another question. To your knowledge, have Google employees been affected by the controversy surrounding Google's part in the tech industry? For example, contributing to the housing crisis and gentrification of San Francisco. So the larger question is, how does Google address its impact on life outside of its business?
Well, so we talk about this a lot inside the company, and it's a very real issue. I mean, obviously, Googlers live in all these neighborhoods, so they experience all this kind of stuff. But, you know, Google pays good wages, so they're not impacted in obviously the same way as somebody who, you know, works in a different company or industry. So we talk about it a lot. It's a really hard problem to solve, and, you know, it's not clear what a good solution is. And even things like, you know, I mentioned the shuttles earlier, where the whole idea was do something good, take cars off the road. It turns out it has this externality of wherever the shuttles stop, real estate prices go up around that. And then if you move the shuttle stop, then real estate prices drop and they go up somewhere else. And that like both upsets people and makes people happy. And so, you know, the fundamental issue is, you know, there's just not enough housing stock, right? And not enough well-paying jobs.
But do you have to do things like on a bigger scale then like try to lobby on housing stock in San Francisco? And
yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we also have some crazy ideas that never left the conference room. I'll get in so much trouble. but what I will say, one of the things we've been doing is, you know, you watch, and you can say this is sort of, you can argue this isn't sufficient. But if you look at what Walmart and McDonald's have done in terms of raising wages voluntarily, or depending, you know, how you look at it, but they've chosen to raise wages. I think large companies can have disproportionate impact on questions like wages and benefits and things like that. So one of the things we've done is, you know, Google employees, you know, we have a very aggressive compensation philosophy. What we've also started doing is talking with our vendors, our partners, companies that, you know, do work with and for Google, and sort of, you know, working through them to make sure that the wages there also are aggressive. So there's been some press about what we've done for bus drivers at Google. That's not the only place. It's the place we've talked about publicly. But what hasn't been covered is we've also talked to our partners and said, you know, it's not just about an hourly wage because you need good benefits. So we've also pushed successfully, and with the help of our vendors and partners, for things like 401k with matching, because retirement's a really big deal, health benefit plans where the employees actually of our vendor partners get better healthcare coverage, their dependents get coverage immediately, and there's more and more of that kind of going on. I think companies like Google and other companies can really have a leadership position by saying, you know, sure, we're taking care of our employees, but if you do business with us, you need to take care of your employees, too.
Do you ever hire people over 50 or 60?
Yes. Yes. All the time. Although, you know, we actually don't care what age you are either. And so we hire people of every age. From the outside, it looks skewed because we, like a lot of companies, do a lot of campus hiring. So we hire a lot of interns and a lot of people fresh off campus. But I mean, yeah.
I mean, so what do you make of the claim I've heard, not specifically about Google, but about the tech industry in general, that it's difficult to survive as an engineer at an older age, to get jobs at that age? Like, what do you think of that claim?
Well, it's documented that there's a lot of bias, right? I mean, there was this study done where two identical sets of resumes were sent out, and the first set had the names of people with sort of Caucasian-sounding names, and the second set had African-American-sounding names, right? And it turns out if you have an African-American-sounding name and exactly the same resume, you have to send out 50% more resumes to get an interview, right? And that's the only difference, 50% more. And I've seen research, too, that suggests if you're older, same thing holds. If there's all kinds of things. What we've done at Google is we actually kind of ignore those factors. So we've done experiments where we take, you know, your name off the resume, we take the years off the resume, and we see what happens. Then we give the resumes to recruiters and see, and managers and say, and people involved in the hiring process, you know, how do these candidates look? We don't see a difference when we remove those identifying factors. So that tells me that at least people may not be applying as much, but once they do apply, your odds are the same, at least at Google. And I think it goes back to this question of, we all think we're fantastic at hiring, but we're all a little biased because we're human beings and we're not as good as we think. But it's fixable by first saying, you know, I've got a problem, and then ignoring the stuff that's going to cause you to make bad decisions. I just, you know, honestly, part of why I wrote this is so that more places hopefully start doing that.
This questioner references a recent New York Times article by one of my colleagues, actually, about the difficulty of balancing work and life for working parents. What do you think Silicon Valley companies can do to help retain top talent who are also parents?
I think the single biggest thing is better maternity leave and paternity leave. We used to offer 12 weeks of maternity leave and with just this California standard, and you'd have salary continuation. And what we and one day I was driving to work and thought, well, that is kind of a crummy policy. And, you know, sometimes even at Google, we're top down in our decision making. So I came in and said, I think we should offer 6 months of maternity leave with salary, bonus, stock. The team said, that is absolutely crazy. It's going to be incredibly disruptive. I said, how about 5 months? And they said, okay. So I should have said seven. So we implemented that. And what ended up happening, because my logic was, take the financial pressure completely off, because moms were saying, like, I feel like I have to come back to work. And second, there's a huge developmental difference between a 12-week-old and a 5-month-old child, right? And you just feel different giving that child in the care of somebody else. What we found later when we ran the numbers was that it turns out women had been attriting at twice the rate of men after coming back from maternity leave or after going out on maternity leave. And when we implemented this policy, the attrition rates leveled out. And then years later, somebody said, well, actually, it's kind of what you're doing is you're pigeonholing women by giving them this much, much better benefit than for men. And you're sort of encouraging women to take this leave while telling men you got to stay at the office and, you know, guys, you got to work, women take time off. And men miss out on the parenting, and we're sort of perpetuating the societal pressure. So we again said, well, you're right. And so we equalized the benefit. The only difference is, for women, there's actually a medical disability piece because you're actually having a baby, and men don't get that piece of it. But everything else is the same.
But what about beyond that? So, you know, if I'm working at a company like Google and maybe commuting from San Francisco, I'm probably there until 7, 8 o'clock at night. And then some companies, I don't know if Google does, but some other companies have things like hackathons that require me to be there all night. You know, just various other kind of like work-life balance questions beyond the maternity, paternity leave part of it.
Well, what our general approach has been to give people the freedom to kind of craft their own solutions. And that sounds like a total cop-out, like I'm saying, like, oh, you know, they'll figure it out. It's not my problem. There have been some things we've done. Like in our Dublin office, we did this thing called Dublin Goes Dark, where basically someone from the People Ops team sat with a cardboard box by the exits to the office and said, as you leave, give me all your devices. Because one of the tricks to finding these moments of solitude is the other idiots who are sending you emails all the time need to stop sending you emails, right? So if you take away everyone's devices, you're forced to have that. We snuck in... I guess it's public now. We snuck in an extra vacation day in our vacation schedule. We didn't tell people about it. Actually, I'm going to get in trouble because we didn't actually tell employees we did this, but 3 or 4 years ago. And what ends up happening, we snuck it in around the holiday season. And over 3 or 4 years, what happened was people just started kind of all phasing out. And so things are pretty quiet now because everyone's like, oh, okay, I get a little extra time. May as well add an extra 2 days. I get all this vacation. But the biggest thing we've done is we're doing this longitudinal study called Google DNA, which is modeled on the Framingham Heart Study. Very cool work. And each year we pick, or every 6 months, an area of focus, and we focus on well-being. And what we found was 1/3 of Googlers are segmenters, meaning that they leave the office at whatever time, they shut it off, they're totally not stressed. It just doesn't bother them. They like can completely turn off work and go home. Whatever the time, they live happily ever after, their well-being scores are off the charts. 2/3 of the company are integrators, which means work and life kind of blend together. Of those 2/3, half of them totally aren't troubled by it. So these are the people who, like, at 10 o'clock at night will check their email before going to bed. Won't stress them out. They'll sleep like a baby. They'll wake up at 6 or whatever, check their email again. Fine, you know, office is on fire. No worries. I'm going to have some oatmeal and go for a run, then come into the office. But the other half of these folks, so 1/3 of the company, are actually integrators, and it freaks them out. It stresses them out because they don't want to be constantly checking. And so we're working on ways, we're testing a bunch of things to teach people how to, like, avoid that sense that you always have to be on and how to moderate the way it feels so that they can get that distance. And for us, it's more about that than the hours, because you can come and go whenever you want. You know, you go to the basketball game, be home for the kids, you're free to do that. So it's not about the hours, it's more about how we process it and how we react to it.
Please describe your performance management process and the criteria you use to determine if an employee gets a promotion or a raise or a big bonus.
How much time do I have left?
5 minutes.
The abridged version, we used to do it in a super complicated way. Really, really Byzantine and super complicated in terms of performance ratings. We stopped doing that. What we now do is we have 5 performance ratings. So the whole history of academic research on and consulting research on performance management basically concludes no one has any idea what works, except goals are important. So number one, we have goals. We have these things called objectives and key results. Larry sets annual goals. He sets quarterly goals for the company. Everybody else comes up with their goals. We don't run a whole process where we sync them up. What instead happens is over 2 or 3 quarters, they kind of naturally line up because people are like, oh, yeah, mine were bad this quarter. I'm going to sync them up. Twice a year, you get a performance rating. Performance rating is drafted by your manager, and then there's a committee of managers who sit down and calibrate because you don't want easy graders or hard graders to unfairly benefit their team. You also want the managers to get to know one another. At the end of the year, you get performance feedback, developmental feedback from your manager, your peers, and people subordinate to you and other people around the company. Then eventually, you also, if you're a manager, you get upward feedback surveys twice a year, 10 to 12 question survey that your teams get, and it's anonymous, and that tells you how you're doing. And then we have an annual employee survey called Google Geist, which sort of measures how everything is doing, but you can also cut it by manager. So that's how performance is managed. The way it ties to pay is very, very, very loosely, and to promotions. Because for every job level, we have documented standards of what impact you have to have and kind of, you know, what performing at, you know, a level 6 versus a level 7 or what have you looks like. And your performance rating is an input to that decision, but it's not the determinant. When we set bonuses, there's, of course, you know, we have your performance ratings, we have what job level you're at, your salary, your bonus target, here's the bonus that is recommended. But then your manager can adjust that. And then there's subsequent reviews, and then my team reviews all of that to make sure there's no bias, that it's fair, that outliers are appropriate. So again, it's an input, but it's not the determinant. So the key is we have a performance system that is actually focused on delinking all these carrots and sticks from the learning process, because what we really want you to do is constantly be learning and growing and developing. And the more you tie someone's specific actions to outcomes like this will determine your promotion or this will drive your bonus, the less likely they are to learn, the more defensive they're going to be when you give them feedback, the more they're going to fight to convince you your feedback is wrong, and the more mediocre the performance is going to be.
Who decides what the next great innovative project will be to work on at Google?
I have no idea. They kind of come from every direction. Some of it is Googlers just saying this is kind of cool and working on it. Some of it is, you know, So we actually, a lot of, there's a lot of theories of innovation. You know, you need a skunkworks and they should be protected and they should do all kinds of things. Or, you know, oh, you need 20% time where people are free to kind of explore things. The reality is, our experience is, there's no single answer. Because it depends on the kind of problem, the kind of team you have, where you want to go with it. And so we actually have a whole bunch of different models. So we have Google X, we have autonomous units, we have 20% time, which actually isn't 20%, but it's actually also not zero. The math is in the book. But it's just a sensitive thing, so it's a little more nuanced than it sounds. And ideas kind of come from everywhere. But Larry Page gives us direction. Sundar Pichai on the technical side for the core Google products gives us clear direction. So there's a lot of focus behind a bunch of areas. And then there's a bunch of stuff that just happens on the margins. Some of it becomes huge and great. The other place innovation happens at Google where it's easy to overlook is on our core products. It turns out, you know, 12 years ago, it was relatively easy to make improvements in Google Search or in how our ads are served. Now it's really, really, really hard, and there's ferocious competition. So there's this constant, you know, can we make it a tenth of a percent better? Can we make it 50 microseconds faster? And when people look at innovation, they think, oh, you know, self-driving cars. But there's this kind of relentless, constant grinding innovation in a bunch of small ways that actually add up to very big things.
Google's creed is do no evil. How does that affect the hiring of confrontational roles like lawyers?
Well, I've been advised by our lawyers not to comment on that question. So, it turns out you can actually be a really good lawyer and be confrontational without kind of being a jerk. I mean, you know, if you've ever bought a car, if you've ever bought a house, if you've ever like rented something, you know, if you've ever gotten a job, you can negotiate, and there's a nice way and a mean way, and sometimes it's actually useful to be able to be a jerk and turn that skill set on. So we hire people who can kind of play all the roles, and you know, sometimes one of the roles you have to play in a negotiation is you have to be bad cop, and so people will do that. But I can assure you, deep down, they're all really nice.
So this is going to be our last question. Since you do experiments to try out HR practices, does this lead to some employees feeling that the rules are arbitrary?
Well, I have a great 45-minute answer to that question. But I'm sure somewhere, we have 55,000 employees, and we hire thousands of new people each year. So I'm sure there's people who feel the rules are arbitrary. And when we survey employees, you know, when we ask the question of do you feel the systems are fair and just, you know, it's not 100% of people who say it's fair and just. So absolutely, yes. What we do, though, to prevent and mitigate that as much as possible is whenever we're sort of doing an experiment or trying to discover something new, we tell our employees what we're doing. Sometimes you need to do double-blind experiments. So when we do that, we sort of, you know, we don't tell them why we're doing something, but we tell them we're testing. We protect their data. So, you know, the team in people operations that actually looks at employee data from our Google DNA study, for example, or our annual employee survey, they don't share it with anybody. Like, I've asked, I don't get access to it. Like, they won't share it with me, which is the correct thing to do. So we keep it very confidentially, and then we share the results back with them. And we say, well, here were the findings, so they can see what came of it. And it's interesting because when we started, we did our first employee survey in 2005, the year before I arrived, and it was just on the engineering side, and 50% of our engineering population participated. And we just did our employee survey again a few months ago, and more than 90% of the company participated. So it's actually become a census rather than, you know, a survey. And we've seen participation increase. And one of the questions is, do you believe we use this information responsibly? Do you believe we take action? And those numbers have gone up. And I think part of the reason people keep responding and providing the input is because we've over time, and it's taken years, built credibility that we respect their privacy, we respect their information, we use it responsibly. And so people, I'm sure there's people who are uncomfortable, and you know, hopefully we can convince them. You know, we're from people operations and we're here to help. So.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.